despite what objections I might have with the actual amount of the price tag, the omnibus was a good compilation.
The federal spending bill sends hundreds of millions of dollars to Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 11th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, rookie mushers lean on their dogs on the way to Nome.
Each one is your buddy. Each one holds your success or failure in their paws. And each one your life depends upon.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Their mission is to advocate for children and youth by assisting school boards to provide quality public education, supporting student achievement and local governance. Information at aasb.org.
Former state Republican Representative Beverly Masick of Willow has agreed to plead guilty to one count of accepting a bribe regarding a program that received federal funds. Masick represented the Mat-Su area from 1995 to 2004. She was accused of taking money from former VECO head Bill Allen to kill an oil tax bill that he did not like. Masick is scheduled to enter her guilty plea tomorrow morning before U.S. District Judge Ralph Beislein. The maximum penalty for conspiracy to commit bribery is 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. But under the plea deal, she faces a prison sentence of 18 to 24 months and a fine of $4,000 to $40,000. All three members of Alaska's congressional delegation voted for the omnibus appropriations bill President Obama signed into law today. The Senate cast its vote on the $410 billion spending bill yesterday. It was carried over from the last Congress because it failed to pass last year and will fund the federal government only until the end of September. Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of only eight Republicans who voted for it. She says she wishes Congress had voted on the spending bill before it took up the massive economic stimulus package passed last month. She says there's no conflict in her support for the omnibus spending bill and her stance against the stimulus package.
The stimulus was an entirely different animal. It did not go through the regular order. It did not go through committees. It was basically a spending package that was crafted by a few individuals and an enormous price tag placed on it, and we were asked to accept or reject it.
The spending bill will send about $200 million to Alaska and includes more than $18 million for village water and sewer projects. More than $3 million will go to the Denali Commission for job training and $5 million for an FAA air traffic control communication system. The earmark-laden bill has come under criticism from some Republicans, but Murkowski defends earmarks and says they are not wasteful by definition. She says as long as it's a transparent process, earmarks are a good way for legislators to send money home since they know what projects are priorities.
I think people back home would feel far more comfortable knowing that their delegates here in Congress were working on those issues rather than trusting an agency to know what goes on in our state and know what our needs are.
President Obama has warned that he wants to see earmarks curbed in the future. Included in the omnibus bill is a provision that will allow the Obama administration to withdraw changes President Bush made to the Endangered Species Act. Four-time Iditarod Trail sled dog race champion Martin Boozer breezed through the tiny town of Takotna, spending less than a minute today before jumping on his sled runners and snatching the lead. Boozer wasted no time as he headed out of the checkpoint, a town of a few dozen people known for giving Iditarod mushers the biggest welcome. He chose to push on, but other mushers, many of them the superstars of the sport, were pausing in Takotna, apparently taking their mandatory 24-hour layovers. Nenana musher Aaron Burmeister was the first to arrive at the checkpoint at 2:44 this morning. Hugh Neff followed about 20 minutes later with Yukon Quest winner Sebastian Schnula close behind. Two-time defending champion Lance Mackey was fourth into the Kuskokwim River Village. When he passed through McGrath a few hours earlier, he said his team was doing well.
Sounds pretty good at the moment. I have no complaints. I'm right where I want to be.
Okay.
Maybe, we'll see how it goes on the other end, but so far, so good.
Race Marshal Mark Nordman was in McGrath warning mushers about the potential for moose on the trail ahead. Jeff King, who left the checkpoint a few minutes after Paul Gebhardt, said he planned to stay right behind him for protection. He also joked about his recent legal trouble over a moose he was accused of shooting in Denali National Park.
Well, I'm going to go with
my
Paul.
Yep, I know.
That's what
let him clear the trail, huh?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't. Go straight through.
I only shoot park moose.
King ended up arriving in Takotna more than half an hour in front of Gebhardt. Mitch Seavey also passed Gebhardt along the way and arrived about 10 minutes ahead of him. Jim Baker, Sim Smith, and Ellie Zirkel are also parked in Takotna. Zirkel's husband, Alan Moore, pulled into McGrath mid-afternoon and left right away. He's in 27th place, but says he is happy that other mushers are ahead of him packing down the trail.
Well, I got plenty of teams out in front of me. Maybe they'll pat it down a bit. That's the good thing about being back here. Gotta be a positive.
That's right. There's always something to look forward to.
A group of rookies are bringing up the rear in the Iditarod this year. Most have day jobs and are making their way to Nome purely for the great adventure and for the love of their dogs. APRN's Annie Fite spent some time with them yesterday at Rainy Pass and has this story.
This is Nellie Dog.
Lou Packer looks like your typical rugged Alaskan outdoorsman. He's tall and strong and even wearing an intimidating camo snowsuit. But then he starts cooing.
She's so sweet when you pet her, sometimes your fingers get sticky from the sugar. Sugar cookie dog. Hey, Hobbs. Hobdog. Yeah. Hobbs is part nincompoop. It's terrible.
On a normal weekday, Dr. Packer would be running an urgent care clinic in Wasilla. But on this day, he's adding up his multiple bruises and considering himself lucky to have made it this far. He says his wedding band used to be round, but is now oval-shaped after an especially bad crash.
You're going from one terrifying, instant, you know, to the next terrifying, heart-stopping, insane moment to the next. I mean, it's nonstop. It's one after another after sometimes it's three or four at once.
Packer hasn't slept more than a few hours at a stretch since the race started, but that hasn't stopped him from being methodical about caring for his dogs. He's especially focused on making sure they're getting enough to eat and drink.
Here, put your microphone down there. Here. This is the dog food. It's kibble, and that's tripe right there, and water. So let's go feed these guys. Actually, we're watering. This is mostly water.
Packer is one of 14 rookie mushers still on the trail to Nome. They're taking vacation from their day jobs for the adventure of a lifetime. Kim Darst is a helicopter pilot from New Jersey. After bedding down her team, she takes a metal bucket over to a small water hole cut into frozen Puntilla Lake.
This might be the most exciting part.
Running the Iditarod is not cheap. Mushers can easily spend more than $20,000 on the entry fee, supplies, gear, and transportation. Dar says she can't afford to do it again, and this is her one chance to make it to Nome. On the other hand, rookie Jen Seavey's future is probably full of Iditarods. The 22-year-old is the daughter-in-law of Seward mushing legend Mitch Seavey.
Put some boots on. All right, you ready to go mushing? Not so much.
Stevie says the trail has been remarkably uneventful. She's running a team of two-year-olds on their first trip away from home, and she has nothing but good things to say about their performance.
You know, I have two three-year-old leaders that are supposed to be like my adult chaperones to show the pups how it's done, and the pups are kind of showing them up, so that's pretty exciting.
Like a lot of rookies this far back, Seavey is taking things one checkpoint at a time. The biggest surprise for her is that she's having so much fun.
I don't know, I'm not tired, and I'm enjoying it and looking forward to each run. It's really cool.
Dr. Lou Packer also seems to be having fun. He says everything has been wonderful. The people, the checkpoints, and even the trail in its own sometimes frightening way. But he reserves special praise for his dogs.
You know, each one has its own unique personality. Each one is your buddy. Each one holds your success or failure in their paws. And each one your life depends upon.
No one has ever died running the Iditarod, but Packer jokes his wife is convinced he's going to be the first musher to earn that dubious honor. He hands me a slip of paper with her phone number and asks me to pass along the message that he's doing great. Then he looks down and frowns at his overstuffed sled.
Okay, sled's all packed. All they do is booty and beat it.
Packer says he has a classic rookie bulge on top of his sled with a lot of unnecessary gear packed in. But he also says he's intent on surviving this treacherous experience, and you never know when some of that extra stuff might come in handy. In Rainy Pass, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, searching for a shipwreck near Homer.
I'd never done any diving of this sort before, and it was fascinating.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Interior Department has a new focus and commitment to renewable energy projects. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar signed today his first secretarial order establishing the production, development, and delivery of renewable energy as a top priority.
The purpose of the executive order today is to send a loud and clear message across all of the agencies of the Department of Interior that we are in the renewable energy business, that the days where we were simply as a department handing out leases for oil and gas and other mineral extraction are now going to be a very expanded mission for our department.
Salazar was quick to say that the Interior Department will continue to develop oil and gas on public lands, but he criticized the Bush administration for limiting its focus to that.
Renewable energy companies stand ready to develop these resources and are looking for a partner in the federal government. But for the last administration, renewable energy simply was not a priority. They focused their time instead on almost exclusively on permitting for oil and gas. But in their focus on oil and gas alone, renewable energy permits stacked up.
Salazar says the Interior Department will give a priority to processing permits for renewable energy generation and transmission on public lands. He cited 140 million acres in Alaska and western states with significant geothermal resources. Salazar says they're also looking at wind, solar, biomass, and small hydro projects. Salazar will visit Anchorage on April 14th. The Interior Department announced today the date of next month's public hearing on offshore oil and gas development. Last month, Secretary Salazar put on hold a Bush administration plan to open up more of America's waters to offshore development. He criticized it as favoring the oil and gas industry over American consumers and renewable energy companies. Legal experts are urging Canada to work with the new U.S. administration to resolve long-standing Arctic issues between the two countries. The U.S. and Canada dispute the boundary in an area between the Yukon and Alaska, and they disagree over the status of an ice-free Northwest Passage. The CBC's Patricia Bell reports.
Submarines traveling through Arctic waters. Inuit hunters and rangers have noticed them for years. Michael Byers holds a Canada research chair in global politics and international law. He believes U.S. nuclear-powered submarines are likely heading through the Northwest Passage this month, en route to an exercise in Alaska. Byers says what matters is whether the U.S. is asking permission to go through the area, not just informing Canada about the trips.
They are international voyages through the Northwest Passage. And so the question in terms of Canadian sovereignty becomes, does the Canadian government know that they're going through the passage? And if so, has it given its consent?
Byers says it's time for Ottawa and the U.S. to work towards an agreement on the passage and Canada's sovereignty over it, and to work out the dispute over where the boundary lies in the Beaufort Sea between the Yukon and Alaska. That dispute will have to be resolved before either country can claim an extension of their sovereign rights in the area under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. The U.S. hasn't yet ratified UNCLOS, but Betsy Baker says it's heading in that direction. She's an associate professor at the Vermont Law School.
With the new administration and also with the melting ice and the interest in reaching the hydrocarbon resources up there, we think that that might be yet another factor that will move in favor of ratification.
Baker hopes the U.S. will ratify the convention this year. Patricia Bell, CBC News, Iqaluit.
A documentary about a 140-year-old Cook Inlet shipwreck played to a packed house at the Homer Theater last weekend. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
The sinking of the Torrent in July 1868 is believed to be the oldest shipwreck of Alaska's American period. The large three-mast sailing vessel struck a reef near the village of Port Graham less than a year after the U.S. purchased Alaska from Russia. More than 140 people escaped, and although no lives were lost, the survivors, including about 130 U.S. Army soldiers, many of whom were veterans of the Civil War, spent 18 days waiting to be rescued as the ship broke up offshore. Last year, a crew led by Steve Lloyd, a shipwreck historian and co-owner of Tidal Wave Books in Anchorage, successfully recovered a number of artifacts from the wreck site. The crew took video of the whole thing from start to finish, and Lloyd put together a film titled The Torrent Shipwreck, Searching for Alaska's Underwater History. Alan Olson is a Homer-based diver who was part of the search for Torrent artifacts. He also had a hand in the filmmaking process.
I got involved in diving for the artifacts and the recovery of the artifacts when one of the other divers on the team fell ill. And I just happened to be available. And it worked out really well because I had never done any diving of this sort before, and it was fascinating.
Olson says he had no idea that the Torrent shipwreck was there, almost literally in his backyard, until Lloyd mentioned it to him last spring. He says searching for the remains of the boat in Kachemak Bay presented some unique challenges for the divers.
It's a very difficult place to dive. The water is really deep, and when we were there in May, there was already starting to be a lot of kelp growth, and so it was a difficult exploration, but it was pretty cool.
Olson says when they first dove the wreck site, Lloyd led him to some rudder parts, portholes, and other remains of the ship. They then went into what dive team members called Cannon Canyon. There they discovered a bronze mountain howitzer cannon, one of four that the Torrent had on board, and the only one that went down with the ship.
If you can imagine this, it's about a 35-foot deep canyon that's only about 6 or 8 feet wide at the top, narrowing down to about 4.5 feet wide at the bottom. And at the bottom of it was the mountain howitzer. And he took me down there and picked up a cannonball and kind of held it up to the muzzle, and it was fabulous.
The film recounts how the actual recovery of the artifacts was complicated by the various state and federal agencies that had to be involved. Ultimately, the Coast Guard cutter Hickory brought the artifacts to the surface. The items have since become the property of the Alaska State Museum, but Heather Beggs, director of Homer's Pratt Museum, says it's likely that they'll find a permanent home in Homer.
We have a really good relationship with the State Museum at the Pratt and have worked with the state archaeologist Dave McMahon for a while, so it looks good that the Pratt would be the repository for these artifacts on long-term loan, basically, from the State Museum. They really like to keep things local, close to the local site where objects are discovered, and we have an accredited museum, so that's a natural place for these to rest.
Beggs says she hopes the Torrent artifacts will become part of the Pratt's plans for an expansion project the museum hopes to undertake in the next few years. She says the public is invited to give input into what a permanent exhibit will look like and include. The Torrent shipwreck film has now played in both Anchorage and Homer. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
Alaska's national forests are getting $2.4 million from the economic stimulus package signed into law last month. It will go toward building projects in the Tungusa and Chugach National Forests, ranging from building repairs to trail maintenance. The funding is part of the first phase of the nationwide total of more than $1 billion the Forest Service expects to eventually receive under the stimulus bill. Alaska Senator Mark Begich says there could be more distributed over the next few months.
This is only 10% of what's available, and so we see potentially more Alaska projects coming down the pike. But this is a great sign, getting money out as quickly as possible, creating jobs. This $1 billion, once completed and out there, should produce around 23,000 jobs, which, again, is very exciting. Alaska, I think, is going to be a huge benefactor of that.
Agency spokesman Phil Salmon says the money will go toward projects that are ready to go.
Projects that the planning is already done, the Environmental Policy Act compliance work has been done. Everything on these projects is ready to go so that money that is allotted or appropriated for these projects can be released immediately and the projects can start within about a 7-day period.
The agency says the projects include repairing and resurfacing Forest Service roads, as well as failing bridges and up to 120 problem culverts that can block fish from crossing under logging roads. Salmon says the regional forester submitted requests for a total of $164 million worth of projects for the two national forests in Alaska, and the agency expects to hear later this month about additional funding. A survey of Ketchikan visitors suggests some new directions that could help boost the city's tourism industry. The research also points to potential for other towns that attract out-of-state anglers. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Ketchikan and most other coastal communities see a lot of tourists who fish, and it's no surprise to anyone in the business that most of them are men, the majority traveling without their spouses. Susan Bell of the McDowell Group research firm says some of those men told surveyors they have no plans to change.
6% said this is a men's trip. This is my dude time. Back off. No. But 5% said the spouse didn't want to come. 1% said cost. 1% said I prefer to travel alone.
But about a quarter of visiting fishermen do bring their wives or partners, and surveyors found many of the rest are willing to consider it. Bell presented her research at a recent Ketchikan tourism conference. She says it's unclear how many women want to head out fishing with their men, but more might come along on the trip if lodge and charter operators let them know there are other things to do.
She gets to do the spa things, go shopping, do other activities, or maybe it's just a message that those of you who have the kinds of destinations that would be appealing to someone who's looking for or something to do while he's going to be fishing and she needs to be busy. Think about if that product already exists in your property or in your community.
Some fishing lodges are moving away from the guy-only bunkhouse approach, or at least offering alternatives. A Yakutat business, for example, added cabins with private rooms and queen-size beds last year because more families were interested in coming to visit. Bell says changing accommodations or adding features won't automatically bring in spouses and families. She says the changes have to be reflected in marketing.
Understanding who the party is, who they're coming with, what their motives are, helps you as a business or helps you as a community to know, well, how much resources should I be putting at trying to change this, or can I incrementally do more to make sure that those people that might bring their spouse or guest know that there are things to do.
She says the growth won't be huge, but creative community leaders and tour operators can use the information to develop new markets. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
Scientists are currently exploring a possible link between commercial fishing practices and smaller fish size. KDLG's Adam Cain reports.
A research paper was recently published documenting a lab experiment where scientists studied the evolution of fish stocks in response to harvest selection over 10 years, specifically to find out if catching and keeping the largest fish from a given population would eventually lead to generations of smaller fish. Fisheries ecologist Steve Munch with New York's Stony Brook University worked on the recently released study. Around 4 years into the experiment, scientists started to notice something interesting.
What we found in the first
five generations of the experiment when we were doing this selection is that the fish evolved fairly rapidly in response to harvest selection. That is, the ones where we were harvesting the way typical fisheries do, that is, removing the largest fish, evolved a substantial decrease in yield in just the first 4 or 5 generations.
The experiment didn't end there. The scientists continued on for another 5 years, asking themselves, what happens after harvest selection is relaxed? That is, when fish are taken randomly.
We found that, at least in the ones that were in the typical fishery, where we're removing the biggest fish, that they did show a rebound. That is, they had an evolution back towards their original growth trajectories. So when we stopped fishing on them in a size-selective way, they sort of started to come back to what they were before.
This is good news, he says, particularly because it shows a faster recovery than previous studies had shown. The faster recovery, however, applies to generations instead of actual years, which amounts to considerably more time when applied to fish such as salmon, which have a typical lifespan of 4 to 7 years, or cod, which can live as long as 30 years. So what can be done to prevent an undesired evolution?
I think the next really big thing is to try and figure out whether, okay, given that it is happening, what can we do about it? And one of the things that we can do about it is change the size selectivity with which we remove fish. And another big thing that we can do, this is the sort of obvious and easy one, is fish less intensively. Of course, that's never popular.
And someone who knows how unpopular a reduced fishery can be is Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Commercial Fisheries Director, John Hilsinger, who believes the results of the experiment are possible in theory. However, through extensive fisheries management, he believes there's little chance of this actually happening.
In commercial fisheries, number one, we don't harvest 100% of the big animals. We have escapement goals, and then we have harvest rates that are normally much lower. And even in some areas of Bristol Bay where the runs are very healthy right now, after over 100 years of commercial fishing, we still only have harvest rates that are generally in the 70 to 75% range at most. And so we're harvesting at rates that are far lower than what some of these studies have used.
He goes on to say that using a specific mesh size helps harvest the most abundant amount of fish as opposed to the largest fish of a given population.
That's why in a lot of areas of the state you see mesh size restrictions. The mesh size can't be larger than a certain amount or it can't be smaller than a certain amount. And we use that to try to have a mesh size that targets the middle of the size range of the species in that area.
Hilsinger says the Department of Fish and Game is always concerned with the state of the fishery, and studies with regard to mesh size selectivity are currently underway. He goes on to say that if a problem in the fishery was to be found, they would certainly propose related changes to the existing regulations. For now, the little fish problem seems to be contained to the lab in Stony Brook, New York. Here in Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from David Shurtleff on the Iditarod Trail, Patricia Bell in Canada, Casey Kelly in Homer, Joe Viknicki in Petersburg, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Adam Kane in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.